Okay, so thanks everybody for being here and sticking it out for part two. So last week I talked to you a little bit about the really interesting evolutionary dynamics that we can see in these sort of laboratory microbial evolution experiments, and I talked a little bit about some maybe new theoretical models for understanding the dynamics that we see from this kind of data. I think this is all really, really interesting, but the question was raised a couple times by different folks in the audience about whether this basic picture of evolution that we get from these experiments is actually an accurate reflection of microbial evolution in the wild. I think this is actually a really great question and one I've been thinking a lot about lately. So when it comes to natural populations of microbes, a lot of our most detailed information about the evolutionary dynamics comes from pathogen populations. I think for these, the answer is probably yes. So for example, these allele frequency trajectories from this recent study of within host HIV evolution carried out by Fabio Zanini and Richard Nayer and collaborators looks pretty similar to the kinds of allele frequency trajectories we saw in the Lenski experiment. But I think to really get at this question, we also have to understand what's going on in sort of more boring everyday populations of bacteria, you know, those that might not be subject to the same sort of strong, constant immune pressures faced by many pathogens. So for a variety of reasons, some of which I'll get to today, I think the gut microbiome is actually really precisely the kind of boring population of bacteria that we'd want to study in this context. And it also has some really natural connections to the sorts of coupled ecological and evolutionary processes that I talked about in my talk last week. So in collaboration with Nandita Garud, who's a postdoc in Katie Pollard's lab at UCSF, we've been trying to take a careful look at the data to see what we can learn from the evolutionary dynamics that take place in this more complicated microbial ecosystem. So I want to tell you a little bit about that work today, and in particular what I think we can still learn from these large metagenomic surveys like the Human Microbiome Project. Okay. So most of what we already know about the evolution of commensal gut bacteria focuses either on relatively long sort of speciation level timescales like those that connect humans and chimps, or on the really great sorts of colonization and evolution experiments that Isabel Gordo's group has been carrying out with E. coli grown in mice. So we're going to be interested in what's going on sort of shorter population genetic timescales, which are going to control how mutations arise and spread through the population. In the context of these experiments, we sort of want to know to what extent this colonization process is special in any way, or whether we expect similar amounts of widespread adaptation to be occurring in native populations of gut bacteria as well. So to address these sorts of questions, we've been using data, whole genome metagenomic data from a large panel of healthy human hosts sequenced by the Human Microbiome Project, a subset of which were sequenced a second time sometime between 6 months and a year later. So for reasons I'll get to a little bit later, we also supplemented this data with another 150 or so healthy hosts taken from a Chinese cohort, which was sequenced with this sort of similar technology around the same time. So based on this kind of data, we should in principle be able to learn something about the evolutionary forces that are operating within hosts on short timescales, and also between hosts in the larger human-associated population. The only catch, of course, is that most traditional population genetics methods are designed to work from sequences from the leaves of this tree, whereas in this metagenomic setting, what we actually observe is this sort of complicated mixture of all the DNA present in a big mixed fecal sample, for example. So the intermediate challenge then is to be able to figure out some way of resolving this within host lineage structure sufficiently well, we can actually start to measure the evolutionary changes that would take place on this tree. Okay, so to do this, we start by utilizing a reference-based approach developed by Katie Pollard's lab at UCSF, which aligns these short metagenomic sequencing reads to a large panel of reference genomes that are supposed to represent different bacterial species. The idea is then we can look at the patterns of evolution within each one of these species one by one. Okay, so even after assigning these reads to these different species, there could still be pretty substantial within-species variation in any particular sample in our panel. And indeed, if we zoom in on any particular species, we often observe a really broad range in the amount of within-species, within-host polymorphism in many of the different samples in our panel. So for example, here I've shown Bacteroides vulgatus, which is one of the most abundant and prevalent bacteria in the human microbiome. So I think it's worth sort of digging into this data a little bit more. So you can see that the rates of intermediate frequency polymorphisms, which here I've just plotted the fraction of sites that have a polymorphism between 20 and 80% within a given sample. Varies from something on the order of, you know, roughly one or fewer changes across the entire genome of Bacteroides vulgatus, all the way up to rates that start to approach the typical sequence divergence between different sequence isolates. So these really low polymorphism hosts, the polymorphisms could plausibly have been generated, have accumulated within the host after an initial colonization event and an expansion and the accumulation of just a few quick mutations. But a pretty simple back-of-the-envelope calculation can tell you that these high-diversity hosts are inconsistent with this sort of model. Right? Instead, the only way you could have accumulated this many polymorphisms within a sample is if the person was colonized by two different strains of bacteria that had diverged for a pretty long time before colonizing the host.
I'm just wondering about, you know, when you're doing this alignment, I mean, doesn't that have a big impact on, you know, the artifacts of when you consider something as aligning versus not aligning and how you define what a species is?
Yes. So this is sort of a tough problem, and so, you know, I can tell you a little bit about you know, what we do with this reference-based approach. And so basically they trawl NCBI and find all the possible genomes that exist in the world, and then you have to sort of think carefully about how you cluster those down into a sort of smaller set of species. Right? And then when you do the aligning, you also have to be really careful about making sure that you only consider things that sort of uniquely align to a given position and not to like 10 different bacteria across the panel. Right? And then you have to pick thresholds for sort of roughly how many changes you can tolerate. So in our case, these guys maybe at sort of the highest range, the threshold is roughly 5% divergence on a given read. Right? So when we start to see divergence that approaches sort of 5%, you might start to worry a little bit about what's going on here. But for stuff down in sort of the 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 range, I think we're in sort of relatively good shape. You always have to be careful that, you know, maybe some of these tiny ones down here are just sort of duplicated genes that have accumulated a SNP or something like that. But I think in the broad scale, we do a pretty good job of dealing with these kinds of issues. And it's interesting, it's actually a really interesting fact of the data that, you know, the lineage structure amongst all the species in the microbiome is set up in such a way that you can kind of do this with short reads, right? Like, it didn't really need to be possible that, like, in 100 base pairs, you can sort of uniquely pick out amongst a variety of different lineages in the host. But
yeah, I mean, another way to put this is, right, like, you say that, like, this plateau, I mean, let's forget about the 10 to the minus 1, but, like, this plateau at 10 to the minus 2 is stuff that must be sort of, you know, two independent colonizations of the host by something that you're calling that species, right?
Yeah.
But, of course, you know, if you keep going, if you just didn't classify things by species, you'd have a bunch of other steps, right, that correspond to just all the different species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, that's, of course, not surprising at all, right? So is there like a separation of scales here somehow?
Yeah, so we'll see. I see. I'm kind of zooming on this one. In the next slide, we'll understand sort of where this is coming from. Not all of them will have such a sort of multi-level structure here, so we'll see that in a little more detail.
It seems like a lot of these issues can be addressed moving forward by creating your own reference genomes, which will become easier and easier, at least for some subset. Obviously, you can't get thousands and thousands, but at least you could verify from the sampled set, you could reconstruct an entire genome.
Yeah, and people have sort of done that a little bit with sort of picked out isolates, of course. You know, the problem is many of these things are not really culturable, and so it's a little hard to...
Well, theoretically with nanopore, you could...
Yeah, theoretically with nanopore, yeah. And, you know, I'm not going to talk about this today, but I've been working on sort of a separate project where people have been doing some sequencing with 10x sequencing, which gives you a little bit of linkage information sort of on 50 kb, 60 kb scales, But yeah, for the moment, I think there's just so much of the short read data out here, we have to sort of figure out a way to understand, you know, what we can still sort of squeeze out of it before moving on to these different technologies.
You say similar technology, and the environmental samples, I know the variance is immense, just changing which sequencing, which library prep method. So I'm curious about your comparison with the Chinese.
With the Chinese cohort, yeah, I mean, that is definitely... an issue. It was sequenced by a different lab. You know, so the Human Microbiome Project, they were relatively careful about trying to sync things up between different sequencing centers and then doing some replicates to make sure that things sort of matched up on that level. The Chinese cohort is a little bit more complicated, but as you'll see for us, that's sort of more of an add-on, that really the interesting stuff is going to happen in the Human Microbiome Project cohort, because those are the ones that we actually have some temporal information for. The Chinese cohort's just sort of one static snapshot that lets us learn a little bit about sort of geographic differences between really broad groups. But you're right, you sort of have to be careful that those aren't all sort of dominated by library prep differences and things like that.
Second concern is you have two data sets, essentially, from taken one day one and then 6 months later or
yep.
a year later.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to draw any inference in regards to drift or, I would say, recolonization or anything of the sort, really, with just two data sets to have.
Well, so I think, well, we'll get to this on a later slide, but I think actually what will save us is that in a large enough panel, you can start to learn things about those processes, even with just two time points. And yeah, we'll get to that in a second. Okay, so for the time being, all I want you to take from sort of this particular data is that this can't have accumulated within a host. There's no possible way, even with the highest mutation rates and generation rates and host lifetimes. So instead, we think these are colonized by sort of multiple strains that had diverged for a long time. But you can also show relatively easily that the alternative simple hypothesis also isn't true, right? That every person is actually colonized by, let's say, a million different strains randomly sampled from the environment, such that everybody's microbiome looks sort of like a mirrored copy of what's going on in the bigger population. And you can see this by just looking at the distribution of allele frequencies within individual samples. So I plotted four different examples here for some ones with relatively high coverage in Bacteroides vulgatus. And so if you look at these different distributions of allele frequencies, you can see that some of the individual samples look like they might be colonized just by a single dominant strain. But others look like they could be a more complex mixture of two or potentially more strains. So this is, you go along the genome, right, to all synonymous sites, right? And then you just measure the frequency of the polymorphism that you see at that site. So it could be zero if there's nothing. But maybe it's, 10%. And then you put a little guy here. And so this is just sort of binned.
So the x-axis is...
I totally cut off the x-axis. Yeah, sorry, this is minor allele frequency, right? So you go to a
bottom
given...
Bottom one is somebody that was colonized by a single strain.
Precisely, presumably, right? Or at least a strain that's at a frequency that's much lower than 1 over 165.
Second, for the bottom, they've got one strain at about 90% and one at about 10%.
Roughly, yeah. This one would be two at like 50%, right?
How's the y-axis normalized?
It doesn't really matter because it's the fraction, it's just a distribution.
Yeah. But it doesn't reflect, personal...
So basically what I've done here is I've cut it off, because if you think about it, if the polymorphism rate is like, 1% or 10%, then actually the vast majority of sites that you look at are always going to be invariant, right? And so there's actually a huge spike at zero here, which I'm not really showing you. The interesting stuff happens sort of away from zero. The ones closest to zero are going to be dominated by sequencing errors. So, maybe these couple blue lines here are not super interesting. And that's actually sort of why I've grayed out this zone here. I want to be super conservative about sequencing errors and weird things like that and only focus on stuff that's sort of in this intermediate frequency band. Okay, and so that's actually what's plotted here. It's the number of fraction of polymorphisms that fall in this little white zone. All right, so sorry for not having an axis here.
How large are these contigs that you're looking at? Average.
Yeah, so it varies a little bit from species to species. In the case of Bacteroides vulgatus, I think we actually just switched this in the most recent round of sequencing, but I think the first one might have had 30 contigs across the full 6 megabase genome. They have a better one now that's a complete, they claim to be a complete genome, so we were rerunning things with some of those better sequence isolates. So it's worth pointing out, and I'll sort of mention this on the next slide too, that we're really worried about these sort of like, reference genomes and syntony artifacts and things like that. So we're only looking at sites in genes, right? Sort of as a first pass to sort of not worry about what weird stuff that's going on.
If you compare different species, you will have different cutoffs of which fraction of the genome you could actually analyze, because otherwise we'll get ambiguous mapping. So
precisely.
RDNA genes, they are completely useless. And so you have a real gradient depending on how close your two species are, whether you can include a gene or not. So how do you account for this things?
The threshold used here for different species is roughly 5% divergence across the genome. It's not homogeneous, exactly.
So this is exactly the point.
Yeah. Yeah, so some of the genes are going to be too close to each other and they get sort of removed just because we can't consider things that we can't resolve with short read sequencing.
Yeah, well, my question is, will you include these genes then in another species comparison when this is another more distantly related gene species? So then you could include it because then you still have sufficient information for this one because it will not map unambiguously. So you will have a, eventually, if you don't restrict yourself to the genes that even among closely related species, you can distinguish between the two species, you have different gene sets.
Yes, we definitely have different gene sets.
How does this affect the analysis? Because you will have then...
Yeah, so we can't actually analyze anything about diversity in genes that are very similar between species, and so maybe you could argue those are kind of interesting ones that hop in and out and drive a lot of the adaptive changes.
I'm just curious whether you...
Yes. So we don't look at those at all, right? Anything that's not a unique map in our panel, thrown out, right? So we only look at regions where they sort of species that are present in a given sample are diverged enough that you can sort of unambiguously map reads to different.
Sure, but I'm saying it depends on the genealogy of your sample. So you may have one gene for which you, in one species where you find unambiguous hits, but in the other species it's not unambiguous because there is another close relative, and this has then therefore more polymorphisms or whatever, so you can't...
Not totally sure. Can you say that again? I'm not totally sure I understand.
It depends on the... How close... So it depends on the genealogy of species that you use as a reference.
Yep, exactly.
They're not all equally distant.
Yeah, they're definitely not. Yep.
Then if you have close relatives, then you may get in these close relatives, you get ambiguous mapping, but in the distant one, you will get unambiguous mapping.
So we're always aligning to a giant panel, right? So into Bowtie, we concatenate all these genomes, and that's what Bowtie is using as a reference. So it's never doing sort of a pairwise comparison. It's always
The reads come from the different species.
Yes, exactly.
So if you have reads from a species with no close relative, then you will find also a match.
Exactly,
gene where you wouldn't find a match if you have a pair of more closely related species. And so you end up with different gene sets for different species.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And my question is, how does this affect the analysis?
So I don't know how the unobserved ones would affect the analysis if we had them. So I can just sort of tell you a little bit about the sort of strategy of what we're thinking here, which is to look at, amongst the most boring bacteria, the most boring genes that they have. So the ones that are sort of diverged enough at like the sort of typical divergence between different species that we can sort of resolve these things relatively unambiguously. There's still some issues at the bottom that I can tell you about. And to sort of use these as sort of markers to tell you a little bit about the evolutionary dynamics that's going on. So we're not really going to be able to learn with this sort of method that much about the sort of raw material, like targets of selection, genes that are important in different contexts and not. It's sort of more, are there sort of broad patterns across the genome that you can use to figure out, you know, what's the sort of population genetic environment that these bacteria live in, right? When a new mutation occurs, how deleterious does it have to be before it gets purged out? How beneficial before it sweeps? How long would that take? These sorts of things. So, you know, all these little sort of blue lines here, you can think of them just as sort of elaborate marker SNPs. And we're trying to figure out what are the sort of dynamics of these across the genome. And if stuff gets too weird, basically we try to be careful and throw things out where we don't have a good handle on what's going on. Okay. Right, okay, so in looking across these different samples, sorry again for not including the access label here, we see a pretty wide variety in what's going on. We have some really simple ones like this where you can sort of estimate that it's roughly two strains and maybe you could figure out how to distinguish them. But actually, once you get above, you know, two colonizing strains, things actually start to get kind of complicated. And if you sort of write down the sort of problem of trying to resolve the individual haplotypes from these sorts of distributions of allele frequencies, it quickly starts to get kind of unwieldy, right? So it's a really tough inverse problem. But the way we're going to be able to make progress is that actually, if you look across all the samples in your panel, some of them, like some of the ones I've illustrated here, the lineage structure is sufficiently simple that actually we can resolve the haplotype of the dominant lineage in the sample with a pretty high degree of confidence, right? So we're going to call these confidently phasable samples, which I might refer to as CPS samples. And intuitively speaking, these are roughly the ones that just don't have too many alleles at intermediate frequencies within a host. Okay, although we do have like a specific technical definition, which I'm happy to tell you about later. But for the time being, you can think of it's just the ones without too many of the within host polymorphisms in this sort of white region here. Okay. So so here's a just the distribution of these confidently phasable samples across many of the most prevalent species in the human gut. And so I've colored them, classified as either CPS samples or non-CPS samples. And so you can see that while not every sample has this particularly simple form, in a really large cohort, it's actually not too uncommon to find anywhere from 50 to 100 confidently phasable samples in across the different hosts in our panel. And if you sort of aggregate across the different species, that this amounts to roughly 2,500 dominant haplotypes you can pull out from these roughly 400 metagenomes. So for the rest of this project, I want to sort of skip over this really interesting question of exactly like how the distribution of within species lineage structure could actually be distributed in this kind of weird way, if you think about it. And instead focus on what we can learn just from these confidently phasable samples downstream. Okay, so that's going to be the project. So if there's any more questions about this sort of...
So that top guy, sample one,
yeah.
You have in mind like there's two different things, one of which has... or maybe both of which have substrains, or what?
Yeah, so it gets a little weird as you start to get up to more than two. So two is really simple, and the main reason is that the main reason is really just with two things, there's just a single genealogy that could be going on, and so really it's just a question of estimating the two frequencies of these two things and placing the mutations on each one. Once you get to three, it starts getting a little weird, because you have one genealogy like this, and you actually have a frequency you could be at if you were here, a frequency you could be at if you were here, right? And then a third frequency that you could be at if you were in both, right? But then actually, as I'll show later, these guys are maybe not so asexual, and so actually there's another possible tree that you could have too, right? And this could vary along the genome, and so actually you can easily get multiple peaks and things like that in a more complex sample. So when I first started looking at this, I thought, great, let's just write down like a simple statistical model for pulling out all these clade frequencies. But actually, in the general case, it gets totally messed up. And the reason I put this one here is actually we see a lot of samples that look sort of like that. So rather than sort of solve this problem in general, the tack we're trying to take is there's no reason you have to look at all of your data at the same time, right? If you make your life a lot simpler by looking at half of the data, then should just do that first.
And do you see the ratio between CPS and non-CPS vary with the size of your context, your assembled context?
That's an interesting question. I don't think I've looked at that in detail. What are you worried about?
I'm just curious whether or not that would be reproduced in, essentially you'd have more and more, so called, let's say F1, up to five different lineages. Just based on as you increase in length from 100 base pairs or 100 nucleotides to 500, if it scales.
I see, because you're thinking there's a bigger chance the more sequence you add that you'll have a mixture of strains of that
and
thing.
Then you'd have to normalize to that prior to actually going into the sample.
That's an interesting question. Yeah, I'll have to look into that. I don't think it will actually cause us too many problems because really, well, we might as well just go to the next slide and tell you what we're going to do with this kind of thing, right? So. We're going to be focusing on two kinds of evolutionary changes between the lineages that we pull out of these confidently phasable samples. And the first class are just sort of boring, everyday old single nucleotide differences. We're sort of totally ignoring indels and stuff like this in this first pass. And again, to be careful, we're only looking in annotated gene regions to avoid weird stuff happening maybe at the boundaries of horizontal exchange events. So a single nucleotide difference in this sort of context is going to happen when you have an allele frequency that transitions from some really low value in one sample to some really high value in the other sample, right? And so you have to pick these thresholds relatively carefully because unlike for sequencing clonal isolates, the sort of main way you're going to get an error in this kind of setting is actually going to come through sampling noise, right? So it's not going to be sequencing error, but it's going to be an actual true polymorphism that's at an intermediate frequency in your sample that just happens to be sequenced at a really low value in one sample and a really high value in the other, right? And so this gets increasingly unlikely as you sort of increase your frequency change threshold that you use and as you increase the sort of depth threshold that you use for gauging whether you want to include samples or not. Right, so you have to be sort of a little careful about this, and you can write down a sort of basic error model for this kind of process to try to quantify how many such errors you're likely to see at a given depth threshold, and You know, the upshot is that we try to choose these thresholds in a careful way to ensure that, you know, given the distribution of sequencing coverages and within sample allele frequency distributions, that we expect many fewer typically than one error across the entire genome when we compare two samples. Right? So you have to trust me on that. I can tell you sort of more about the details. That helps to be relatively focused on a relatively confident subset of changes that we see. And it's worth pointing out then that that's how we measure changes. We also are going to want to measure things that don't change. And those are going to be ones that actually stay within this sort of narrow frequency band at both time points as well. So any guy hanging out here in this intermediate frequency band isn't counted either as a change or as a not change in order to be sort of fair about what we're doing here. And so that means that sort of in practice, a lot of the changes we're going to measure are going to be just a small, sort of as Christian mentioned, relatively small subset of sites across the entire genome. And so we have to keep that in mind. Okay, so in addition to these single nucleotide differences, we're also going to be, it's going to be useful to think about differences in gene content between different samples, either in two different people or in one person over time. And it's worth just pointing out briefly sort of how we do this, because it's a little weird. So what we do is, you know, you go back to NCBI and you find all the sort of individually sequenced isolates for a given species. So maybe these are three different isolates of Bacteroides vulgatus that you can find. And so we take these things are going to vary in their genes, and we're going to take these genes and throw them all together into what we will call the pan genome for a given species, right? So this is, of course, just a huge undersample of what the true pan genome for this species actually is, and it varies a lot depending on how many times that species happened to be sequenced in NCBI, and so there's all these sorts of issues, but at least it gives us a set of sort of possible genes to work with for a given species. And then we can look for gene differences by looking at how the coverage of these different genes changes between two samples relative to some class of marker genes that you can pick out that have relatively stable copy number and coverage between samples. So these two things that I've highlighted here would be classified as gene differences.
But if I assume that the variable gene content goes in and out because of horizontal gene transfer, mm-hmm. So how can you be sure that the copy number that you estimate from this is really coming from the species that you have made the pan genome and not from the one that actually was a donor or a close relative of it?
Yeah. That's a great question. So we do a number of things to try to be careful about this, right? So the simplest thing is we actually have quite stringent coverage thresholds for deciding when something is present and when something is absent. So, for example, we only consider something absent if it's less than copy number 5%. That's pretty easy. The other one that's actually more important is when you decide something's present, right? So the sort of coverage of genes can vary quite a lot along the genome just due to sort of where how close you are to replication forks and things like that. And so we only actually consider a gene that's present if it's between, say, 5% of the sort of marker coverage and twofold of the marker coverage. And the reason we do this is A, to avoid sorts of weird, you know, copy number changes in duplicated genes and things like that. But actually, the real reason is to sort of get at your question about making sure you're not randomly seeing genes happening in other species that just happen to be fluctuating in abundance. And so if you sort of restrict yourselves to genes that are sort of present at one time point, then it's actually kind of unlikely that some other strain will just happen to be at exactly the same frequency as this one and one time point and the other. And so this helps you rule out a lot of that sort of stuff. Okay, so this is going to be sort of how we measure gene content differences, and of course it's just a very, very tiny subset of the actual gene content differences that are going to be going on here. It's just sort of our crudest possible way of getting at this process. Right? So it's worth pointing out that these single nucleotide differences, we're only going to be looking at them if they're actually present in both time points. So by definition, this has to be at something that gene content isn't changing. Whereas this lets us get at stuff that could possibly vary between samples and between two time points from the same person. All right. Does this sort of make sense? Sort of raw material that's going to go into this. Okay. So what are we going to do with this sort of data? So I think to really understand what's happening within hosts, it's first helpful to take a step back and think about the typical structure of diversity that accumulates between hosts as well. And so the simplest thing you can do is just calculate the sort of average rate of nucleotide divergence across the core genome between different pairs of samples. So, for example, here I've plotted just the distribution of this average nucleotide difference across all the different pairs of samples in our panel in the case of this Bacteroides vulgata species. Again, sort of most dominant one in the gut. And for visualization purposes, I've also visualized this distribution of distances in this simple UPGMA dendrogram below, where I've just colored the individual leaves according to sort of where the location of the sample was taken. So in HMP, there's actually two cities that the volunteers were drawn from, Houston and St. Louis, I think, and then these Chinese samples. And so in a sort of traditional neutral population genetic model, we would expect all of these distances to be clustered pretty tightly around this value 2NE, where 2 mu NE, where NE is the sort of effective population size of this particular organism. And so in contrast, you can actually see that there's, rather than being really tightly distributed around some characteristic value, there's actually just a huge range of genetic distances that we observe between different pairs of people in our panel. So at the largest genetic distances, which sort of Michael noticed before, we see this sort of large gap in genetic divergence, which corresponds to this initial bifurcation into these two large clades at the top of the tree. So this is probably likely evidence for subspecies of Bacteroides vulgatus that just both happen to be recruited to the same reference genome we used, right? So this is sort of maybe a limitation of picking one threshold for this reference genome panel. You might not always get it right. So consistent with this hypothesis, we find that individual SNPs are rarely shared between these two clades, but are instead confined either to sort of one clade or the other. But you can also see relatively easily that these sort of genetically isolated units can't just have arisen due to sort of standard geographic isolation model, right? So not only is there no real strong correlation between sample and country of origin here, but as Michael noticed before, if we go back to these non-confidently phasable samples, we actually have evidence that some individual hosts are colonized by strains from both of these two clades at the same time, right? So they are sometimes definitely present in contact with each other. Okay, so in addition to these really large genetic distances, we also see some examples of pairs of individuals that seem to harbor really, really closely related strains. So you can see this in a little more detail just by zooming in on the 100 most closely related pairs of samples here. And so as you can see in the tree, I've just sort of highlighted some of the really closely related branches. These individuals aren't clustered into a sort of a single subclade, but are instead distributed relatively evenly throughout the tree. So in principle, you can get these sorts of really closely related strains just with really simple violations of random sampling, right? So for example, in bacteria, you happen to pick two cells from the same sort of clonal expansion of a lineage. Fortunately, the sort of unique two-level population structure of the microbiome here helps us rule out a lot of those really basic sort of sampling artifacts. So not only is it worth pointing out that these different leaves here come from the microbiomes of two totally separated people, so we know it's not just sort of the same cell from a given clone, but if we zoom in, we can actually find examples of some pairs of very closely related strains coming from individuals with either different cities or, in some cases, from different continents here. So this is sort of the real reason we put in this Chinese data set, is to actually see whether this pattern we observe just between different cities can also extend to sort of more diverse populations as well. Right. So we think that this allows us to sort of throw out some of the really simplest... there's one more bit of evidence, too. Which is that actually, if you go in and look at the gene differences amongst these closely related samples... Sorry if it's a little hard to see here, but we see that many of these closely related samples, which would be clustered down here, also have numbers of gene differences that approach sort of the typical number of gene differences between random people. So they vary; it's anywhere between 10 and maybe 50% of the genes in their genome, right? So that these things really, although they are very close in the tree, we actually have pretty good confidence in our ability to distinguish these things from zero. And so, I want you to sort of believe that these two things are not the same clone, right? They really are sort of two distinct bacterial lineages. And so I think this lets us sort of reject the sort of simplest sampling bias artifacts for these sorts of closely related strains, which you might encounter if you were just sequencing E. coli from a lake or something, or if you were sequencing flies from a fruit market, maybe picking cousins. And instead, this might get at some sort of just sort of weird genealogical timescale that's taking place in this bacterial population genetic process that we're just really not used to thinking about in these sort of classic population genetic models. Okay, So consistent with this hypothesis, I've just sort of showed you one example here for Bacchoides vulgatus, but we see similar examples of these sort of anomalously short divergence times in many of the other prevalent gut bacterial species as well, particularly in this, yeah.
Sorry, before yeah. we move on, so yeah. in the previous slide, yeah. are these pairs occur in the same city more often than you would expect on average, or?
I don't know if I've done exactly that test, but we tried to sort of test for these sort of classic geographic differentiation sorts of things, and basically for many of these species, there's sort of no real strong geographic signal. I mean, our data is limited, so you know it's sort of hard to tell. But yeah, for the most part, many of these species, particularly the Bacteroides ones, seem to be relatively well mixed amongst our panel. Though there's a couple that have sort of been identified before. So Eubacterium rectale and Eubacterium elegans are two great examples. They're very strongly differentiated between China and the U.S. So like FST scores are super significant there. But for many of them, they look relatively well mixed. And of course, you can sort of get more into the details and try to figure out different ways of testing this. But another really good test, which I didn't have a chance to show you here, is that if you actually look across species, so a lot of these sort of ideas of geographic isolation and things like that, it's sort of a specific property of the host that's shared amongst the different strains, right? That's why they shared two strains with each other. So a really good test is actually if you compare, you know, Bacteroides vulgatus divergence, right, with like a different species like Bacteroides uniformis, which also has a lot of closely related strains. And if this is some sort of isolation by distance or isolation by diet, or there's a million other things you could think of, you would expect these closely related guys to lie on the diagonal. Instead, what we see actually is the opposite. You know, you have a big cloud and then these sorts of things. So very rarely are the two strains like from the same person. And so I think this gives us more confidence that this isn't, it's something real about the bacteria and not about the host. Although, you know, we obviously could do a lot more to distinguish that. Okay, so we see some examples of these sort of really anomalously sort of broad coalescence time distributions in many of the gut bacteria species, so particularly in the Bacteroides genus. Although if we look carefully, there's also some examples that don't have this pattern, which I think is good because it allows us to exclude some really basic bioinformatic issues that could be causing this. So for example, the Elistopes genus and the Eubacterium genus don't seem to have these examples of these particularly closely diverged strains.
Not really a well-formed question, but you're going through a lot of stuff and I'm finding myself just...
Yeah, sorry. It's,
Can I just back up and ask a really sort of dumb... There's all these different strains of these things that you're finding, right? And they're obviously like all kinds of different colonization events that are creating them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, one model is obviously just that like there's some broad sort of set of these strains out there in the wild with some abundance distribution and everyone is just getting these things more or less randomly.
Mm-hmm.
And is what you're trying to say here somehow that this is inconsistent with this, or are you trying to say it is consistent?
So what I'm trying to talk about is not how the strains necessarily are distributed amongst the hosts, but how the strains are related to each other. So what I'm trying to tell you is that the trees of these strains just look really weird from like a traditional population genetics perspective.
Okay, so what is it that you're, why is it that they're weird?
So I think I might see why this could be confusing. So what's weird is that they're extremely closely related. Right, the coalescence time distribution varies over like three orders of magnitude, right? And it's worth pointing out here that these are genome-wide estimates, right? So maybe in an asexual population on a tree, you know, you expect the first coalescent event to happen one over the sample size, the next one two over the sample size, and so on. This is genome-wide, and so I'll show you on sort of the next slide. To a good approximation, these things are sort of maybe sexually evolving, and so this is actually an average over like, let's say 100 different loci.
So you,
right?
Okay, so what you're saying essentially is like, if this was one randomly mating species, you would not expect this kind of...
How would you happen to find two strains where they, you know...
Fine. Yeah. But I mean, the other hypothesis is that they're, you know, these strains are functionally different somehow, A,
mm-hmm.
and B, there's some geographic, some hidden geographic thing.
Yeah, so I don't think it's geographic for these for this sort of reason over here. But yeah, functionally different, that could be. But again, this will make more sense on sort of the next slide, but I think that's really hard to square up with sort of seeing lots and lots of recombination at the same time. So yes, I agree.
Basically, your point is just that the coalescence time distribution genome-wide is sort of too broad given
your
sexual species.
Way too broad. Right, like if you did this for humans or flies or something, you would expect like 50% variation amongst the whole panel, right? And instead we see four orders of magnitude, right? That's like, there's no model you can write down which will give you that right now. It's kind
of
weird.
No model of some well-mixed, randomly mating population.
Yeah, even a model of geographic isolation is not super easy to get this sort of order of magnitude separation if you think about it. It's tough. And if you do get that separation, you typically have basically signatures of geographic isolation and these sorts of things, which, yeah, we don't think we see too much of, right? So yes, this thing to me is just interesting. It's a really weird feature of these bacterial genealogical trees, and I think figuring out models to kind of understand how you could recapitulate this is an interesting direction to go. It's interesting, you wouldn't really see this unless you sort of looked carefully for it. The sort of typical bacterial divergence times are all sort of well in line with what people see from sequenced isolates.
Well, have you thought of looking at the more defined dissection-dependent, trying to ecologically dissect communities, mm-hmm. essentially plot the data from those types of experiments, whether or not you get better resolution on this?
So what do you mean ecologically?
Micro niche adaptation.
Yeah. So the interesting thing here is, you know, maybe you could do that with these individual species and say, okay, you know, the eubacterium are short because they have one kind of niche, and the Bacteroides are long because they sort of inhabit maybe multiple ones. Within individual species, it's much harder, just because I think we have less of a good sense about like what are the range of possible niches that like two isolates from the same species could maybe colonize. And yeah, I mean, I guess I didn't really have a chance to get at this during my talk last week, but one of the reasons I really like that model is actually if you simulate what's going on with, you know, 50 different resources and let these guys evolve, you actually can get coalescence time distributions that vary on these couple orders of magnitudes, basically because you form this sort of hierarchical set of niches that guys are sort of jumping between and things like that. So
what speaks against it is, for instance, Akkermansia, Rhizophilia, has mm-hmm. a much more limited nutrient source range than others, and its coalescence times perhaps are pretty...
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely much shorter. Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting question. You know, the things we tried to rule out, at least initially, are like, is this a sample size issue that like we see short trees because we don't have enough samples? I don't think that's the case. The other hypothesis was that, you know, maybe something about sporulation and ability to sort of uniquely colonize the host or survive in the presence of oxygen could do it. That didn't seem to be a really good thing, but we haven't really done enough justice to that sort of analysis at the moment.
But for me, if I assume this is all clonal, then I shouldn't be so surprised. Yeah, the thing is, comes just if you say they're all sexual.
Yeah.
They're all clonal, to me, this may be perfectly possible.
If they were clonal, it's not so bad, yeah. I mean, the organization of this maybe could have used some tuning, but yes, in two slides I will tell you that they're definitely not clonal. So another sort of interesting aspect is that, so if you take all those things from the different species and throw them together, you see that in addition to being, you know, really big outliers in the total amount of divergence, these closely related strains also have a really different spectrum of mutations that they accumulate along the tree, which is sort of, to me, further evidence that this is really like a real thing that we're seeing and not some sort of strange sampling artifact. And so what I'm showing you here, I've just broken this apart into the divergence at synonymous sites, and then the ratio of non-synonymous to synonymous divergences between each of these different pairs of hosts. So all the ones from Bacteroides vulgatus I've just colored red here. The rest of the different species are colored gray. And just sort of as a point of comparison, these X hatches here denote the sort of median synonymous divergence and the median DNDS of an individual species. So what you can see here is that there's actually a pretty broad separation in terms of DNDS between the sort of typically related samples in our panel and these really closely related samples, right? So the sort of typically related samples have a DNDS of about, you know, 10% or so. which indicates that purifying selection is relatively efficient on these long time scales. And that's consistent basically with sort of every measurement comparison of bacteria that people have ever done. In contrast, these really closely related samples, DNDS sort of goes back and almost approaches one, which indicates maybe that purifying selection is less efficient at purging some deleterious variation here, or maybe there's adaptation, you know, there's various hypotheses to explain this. And it's worth pointing out, too, that this sort of variation between individuals from the same species is actually quite a bit larger than the variation between sort of medians of different species here. So the sort of quantitative trend here of these points is consistent with a really sort of basic purifying selection null model, where basically these really closely related strains just haven't had as much time to purge deleterious variants that accumulate on branches between them. And so we can model this with a really toy DFE, where sites are either going to be neutral or deleterious with some fitness effect. And if you sort of trust this fit here, which I think actually looks, you know, reasonably good as far as how messy this is, it implies a sort of typical deleterious fitness effect of about 10 to the 5 times the typical mutation rate, so maybe, you know, 10 to the minus 4. And that roughly 90% of the genic sites that we're looking at are under this sort of typical deleterious fitness effect.
The
non-synonymous sites, precisely. And by non-synonymous here, I mean 1D and synonymous 4D, so 2D and 3D.
And this is what gives you the black line.
Exactly. So you can write down a simple model for this, and you get a black line. And basically, you know, this asymptote here tells you the fraction of deleterious things. And basically, where it starts trending tells you roughly the deleterious fitness effect. So this isn't anything fancy. It's just sort of drawing it by eye until it looked good. So if you trust the fit, these are sort of the parameters that come out. Of course, there's a number of other explanations that could sort of reproduce the same pattern. Many of which are sort of more interesting and or more plausible, but I think it's important for us to be able to figure out a way to sort of reject this really simple null model first, because it is sort of the most basic thing that could be going on here. Okay, so now it's the thing we've been talking about too much before. We see these really strong signatures of differences in genome-wide divergence sort of when averaged across the core genome. And this sort of stands in contrast to some other signals that we see, that there's a lot of essentially quasi-sexual evolution happening on these sort of longer intermediate timescales, which is sort of really surprising. The fact that they're sexual is not surprising, but the sort of distinction between these two types of data, I think, is surprising. And so the first thing that sort of gives you a hint that this could be going on is that, you know, I told you in the case of Bacteroides vulgatus, you get this separation into these two top-level clades, which are relatively isolated. But once you get down into individuals from sort of a little bit lower within an individual clade, you find that individual SNPs violate this tree topology all the time, right? Essentially, like, I draw this tree here, but really the only things that we know for sure are these really closely related things and the really diverged things. Everything else in the middle is just sort of a wash, right? So in principle, these sorts of, you know, SNP tree inconsistencies can arise from recurrent mutation or basically just uncertainties in reconstructing these trees, which are kind of tough. So we get a little bit better information by trying to look at the decay of linkage disequilibrium along the genome, right? And so remember, we can measure this now between two pairs of confidently phasable samples, because we essentially know the haplotype of a dominant lineage in both. And so to calculate linkage disequilibrium, we restrict ourselves only to looking at SNPs within genes, because we're a little worried about actually knowing what the syntony is between genes on different parts of the genome. So we just look at all SNPs, and I think, I can't remember off the top of my head whether this is just synonymous ones or maybe all of them. I think it might just be synonymous. So we take all pairs of SNPs within a gene and calculate their distance and calculate some traditional measure of linkage disequilibrium like Kimura and Hota's sigma squared. And then we can also calculate linkage disequilibrium between just two random pairs of SNPs taken from the genome. So that's this point here. This is sort of an estimate of LD between different genes, but with the caveat that most of the SNPs here are from genes on sort of totally different sections of the genome. Okay? And so this is just for sort of one species. You can get a better sense of how this varies across species by just picking a couple particular distances that you want to serve as landmarks. So like maybe 9 base pairs, 100 base pairs, and 2,000 base pairs, and plotting these for the individual species. Like this, and the genome-wide estimate is going to be this circle at the bottom. So it's sort of clear. It's a little confusing the first time, but this is just a way of looking at the decay of lineage disequilibrium across a lot of different species at the same time. Okay. So what we can see here with this decay in linkage disequilibrium is that the typical LD for SNPs in two different genes is much, much lower than the typical LD for SNPs within the same gene, you know, roughly an order of magnitude here, and then pretty similar across a number of the other species. Consistent with the fact that basically all these genes are recombining with each other quite a bit. So it's important that we sort of actually correct for the clade structure in doing this. You can see in this case of Bacteroides vulgatus, if you don't actually correct for the clade structure, you actually get a super flat lineage disequilibrium decay curve, and that's because what you're really measuring here is population structure. And so by looking just in the largest clade, we can actually get some sort of decay. Of course, we don't know whether, you know, this floor here is actually some residual population structure still, but it is sufficient for us to measure a really big difference between within the same gene and across genes. Yeah.
So all this recombining stuff.
Yeah.
Like how do you think that's happening?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there's actually a couple different mechanisms, so it's important to distinguish them. So if you just see a difference between within gene and between gene, the sort of simplest thing you could think of here is just maybe there's like, you know, plasmids or things hopping in and out on, you know, operons going between you know, riding on viruses or transposable elements. And we'll get into that a little bit later. But the other cool thing I think you can see with this data, this is the thing I'm most excited about, is we actually observe an actually pretty significant decay of LD even within genes as well, which is sort of fits less with this picture of like discrete units sort of hopping in and out, and speaks more towards sort of a classic kind of homologous recombination sort of mechanism. Right, so in this case, we see roughly a tenfold decay in LD between, you know, the most closely separated sites and maybe the largest genes that we see. And we observe a similar, you know, roughly order of magnitude separation in many of the other prevalent species as well.
Can you account for the frequency differences, kind of, this in particular between species, you have different sample sizes?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's a bit of an issue, yeah. So it's important to note here that I'm plotting maybe not the traditional measure disequilibrium, R squared, this is sigma squared. So if you think about it, it's basically a way of averaging over the site frequency spectrum at the same time that you're calculating LD. So you're not supposed to sort of plug in these frequency cutoffs that people typically do. And actually to estimate this from the data, we developed some new estimators basically to try to be unbiased towards sample size. So I can't totally rule out, you know, sample size variation between these different things, but I think it's, you know, to me, the cooler thing is actually how similar they all are to each other rather than sort of how different they are. So, you know, maybe if you wanted to compare two, you'd have to be careful and subsample and things like that. But it was a little hard to do this, actually, because, you know, most sort of traditional methods of measuring LD assume that you basically have one size sample. And because of the sort of stringency that we use to whether we included a site or not, the sample size, even for one species, actually varies quite a bit along the genome. And so, yeah, we had to think a little bit more carefully about what we actually, how to actually do this in kind of the metagenomic setting. Right, so we see that, yeah, sorry, I don't know if I answered your question.
I mean, just quickly going back to this homologous recombination, is anything known, for example, about this organism that they, you know, how they would, often they would do that, or?
Not much is actually known about these gut bacteria. So there are some examples where people, they're actually pretty recent, where people have been able to estimate these sorts of rates. Really, I think this is one of the best data sets to be able to do that now. And so it's an interesting point you brought up. You sort of want to know, you know, what does this mean about rates of recombination even, right? And it's interesting that, you know, although we can measure this decay within genes, if you actually compare it to sort of the classic neutral expectation, which is that at long distances it goes like one over the distance between them, you actually see that the observed decay, the sort of shape of this curve, is just sort of totally qualitatively inconsistent with the neutral model. You know, regardless of what recombination rate you assume and how high or low you make the curve. And sort of what this means is that actually, like, if you try to go in and estimate these recombination rates, maybe by looking at how quickly, you know, how long does it take before it decays to its half maximum value or its quarter maximum value, that the estimates you get are going to vary, can sometimes vary quite a bit depending on the length scale that you use, right? So if you use the half maximum value, you might get one value. If you use a quarter, it'll be sort of anomalously longer than you expect it to be. And so that's sort of just what I'm trying to illustrate here. This is maybe like half and a quarter, the two estimates. And so you can see that across the different species, sometimes these things can vary by tenfold, right? So you can kind of get a rough ballpark of these estimates just by fitting this sort of terrible model. But we actually need to think more carefully about how this sort of pattern can actually be produced to really be able to infer what these rates are. Yeah?
Is there, maybe that's a naive question, but is there a way to separate that between the core genome and...
This is all core genome. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. There is, you can go back and look at the variable genes, and I think I remember, we need to do this again, but they were much more recombining, kind of how you would expect, right? So SNPs and variable genes, I think, maybe even hopped across these two clades sometimes, for example. And we'll learn a little bit more about sort of maybe some mechanisms for these sorts of exchange events in a second, actually maybe even right now.
Why is this plateauing your expectation for sexual species? This looks very different, your expectation for linkage distance.
Sorry, yeah, this is on a log scale.
Okay.
Yeah. And that's actually key here because there's sort of two parameters that go into this model. I can just sort of write down what the sort of prediction for this sigma squared is supposed to be. I really should bring over an eraser, but. Okay. Right, so you have the sigma squared, and it's basically supposed to be some function of you know, NE and the recombination rate and the distance between the two SNPs, right? So there's some sort of overall fitting constant that you can use to measure a relative decay, and then there's this recombination rate which goes in here. And so if you actually plot both of these things on a log scale, then all the parameters that you're actually fitting just correspond to shifting this neutral prediction either left or right or up and down. And so the sort of disagreement you see in the shape here is totally independent of actually how you do the fit. And actually, you know, if you go in and look at this kind of thing in lots of different species, it always looks like this, right? So in flies, it decays too slow. In humans, it decays too slow. Basically, like, whenever you look at LD, it always decays way slower than you think. And I think that's super interesting, and I sort of don't have a great explanation for why it behaves this way, but I think it's an interesting observable that we need to think a little bit more about to really try to distinguish between different models. So far I've just been talking about the evolutionary changes that accumulate between hosts, but sort of how I motivated all of this and sort of one of the best uses of these confidently phasable samples is to try to understand the evolutionary changes that accumulate within hosts as well. It's definitely a thing I'm sort of most excited about. And so we're definitely not the first people to look at this question, especially with this HMP data, which has been around forever. So a number of previous studies have shown that, at least on average, the typical number of sort of within-host changes at a microbiome level is much smaller than the typical number of between-host changes. And this has sort of motivated this idea of a microbiome fingerprint, if you will, that can actually distinguish different people in the same way that sort of the regular genome can. And it's worth pointing out that, you know, these things had sort of limited resolution because they weren't actually distinguishing lineages. They were just sort of doing an all versus all comparison of these metagenomic reads. And so a natural question is whether these sorts of microbiome-wide estimates could actually be masking a much smaller number of sort of true substitutions that could be happening underneath all of this. And if this is true, it would in some ways be more consistent with these colonization and evolution experiments that Isabel Gordo's group has been carrying out, which actually sees a number of sweeps occur on a relatively short time scale in the gut. You know, on the flip side, maybe you could also argue that actually native populations of gut bacteria have just been living there so long that they've just exhausted all the possible beneficial mutations that are available in a more complex ecosystem with all these different interacting types. So to try to distinguish between these sorts of hypotheses, We can focus just on the subset of our longitudinally sampled individuals that happen to be confidently phasable at both time points, of which we see that a certain subset are across the different species, these dark blue ones here. So if we focus on these individuals, we can then scan for potential within-host sweeps or fixation events across the genome in a relatively high confidence manner. Okay, so as an example, here's what you get when you carry out this sort of scan for, again, our sort of most favorite example, it's Bacteroides vulgatus. So here I've just plotted the distribution of the number of single nucleotide changes across the now both the core and variable genome of Bacteroides vulgatus, because we expect these things to be relatively more stable on short timescales. So the blue ones are the changes we observe within hosts, and just for comparison, I've just plotted the 50 most closely related pairs of samples in red, just as a point of comparison. Okay. And so what you can see immediately from this kind of plot is that consistent with these previous studies, we also find that in many of the hosts, we don't see any evidence for host-wide sweeps, at least at the sort of boring loci that we're able to look at with our reference-based method. In a couple rare cases, you have individual time points from the same host that are separated by 10,000 different single nucleotide variants. Well within the sort of typical range of between host differences. And we think these are sort of most likely replacement events in which the sort of resident strain is outcompeted by sort of another randomly drawn strain from the environment, which happens to take over because it's more fit.
So, sorry, I didn't get that. So this is pairs at different time points?
Yeah, so each one of the blue lines is two samples from the same person separated by about 6 months to a year. It sort of varies depending on the person. And the red ones are just the most closely related pairs of samples. The typical pair of samples is actually somewhere along these blue lines. So these guys are like roughly in the typical range of between host differences.
So presumably if you take longer times, you would have...
Maybe. It's an interesting question. Yeah, that is one of the interesting unanswered questions here. Whether, we'll get back to this in a couple slides and we can actually estimate this rate a little bit better. Right, so these are sort of relatively rare in this case. And actually, the dirty secret is that there's like three individuals that actually had three time point samples. And I think these are two time points from one of those people. So it went changed and went back, even. These are relatively rare. And then sort of in between these two extremes, we see maybe a handful of individuals that have accumulated just a modest number of single nucleotide mutations, which maybe are candidates for potential sweeps. Right, so the number of samples and the sort of number of SNPs per sample are both relatively low here. It's sort of difficult to figure out much about what's going on with these sweeps. So we can gain a little bit more information by also looking at the gene content differences between individuals within the same individual over time using this sort of systematic differences in coverage that I talked about on the earlier slide. So we again find that these two individuals on the left also have accumulated an anomalously high number of gene content changes, which is consistent with this replacement hypothesis I mentioned before. For the remaining ones, we actually see a lot more evidence for more gene gain loss sweeps, both in terms of the number of individuals that have one of these events and the sort of typical number of genes that are changed when one of these events occurs. So now these gene losses, could totally be consistent with being generated by a mutational process, some big deletion or some transposon-mediated deletion. We saw a lot in the Lenski lines. The interesting thing is these gene gains can only have arisen from some sort of standing variant that happened to have been acquired horizontally from a different strain, which I think is pretty cool. The gene losses could also be consistent with that kind of model, too, if the sort of, invading chunk sort of homologously recombined with something that was there and deleted it, or had a chunk that didn't have one of the genes, so sort of actually hard to distinguish. So if we look at the actual identities of the genes that are changing within hosts, we see that they are they tend to be preferentially clustered in the accessory or variable portion of the genome, sort of consistent with what you'd expect if these ones are sort of more easily swapped between strains and maybe are particularly tuned for growth in particular environmental conditions. There's also some evidence that the individual gene changes that we see here aren't really independent, but instead sort of come all linked together in some individual block. Again, it's a little hard to see this using with the syntony problems we have with our reference panel. But if you look at sort of neighboring pairs of genes, conditioned on seeing a gene change at one gene, there's actually a significantly elevated copy number change in the gene immediately to the left or the right of it. So it's important to note here that these the number of independent gene exchange events that we see here are actually probably much lower than the sort of total number of genes that are changed, right? So maybe each of these could actually have been caused just by a single gene transfer event rather than 10 or 20. Okay, so we see, you know, if you look across the different prevalent species in this panel, we see pretty similar patterns in many of the other ones as well. And so if you take my word for that at the moment, I think the much more interesting thing we can learn is by pooling all of these small number of changes across the different prevalent species in our panel, right? So this is like, you know, horrible, you're combining things that are biologically very different, but I think it gives us a little bit of insight into sort of the general patterns of what we see. Okay, so here I've just taken all the changes that we observe within hosts across these different prevalent species and thrown them all into one big bucket, right? And so so here I'm just showing you the sort of distribution of the number of either single nucleotide changes or gene changes across the different pairs of, across the different individuals at these pairs of time points. Okay, and so we can see almost immediately a pretty clear separation of scales here between these really pairs of time points with really large single nucleotide differences, which we'll call these sort of replacement events. Here you can see they actually make up a relatively small fraction of the total number of time points that we see, roughly like 3%. Although if we weren't careful, they have enough changes associated with them that they would completely dominate the signal of like the average number of nucleotide differences over time, if you didn't actually exclude these from further analysis. So for now, I'm just cutting all of these out and only focusing on this smaller subset, about 20% of our panel, that accumulates sort of a modest number of single nucleotide variants that I'll refer to as sort of evolutionary modifications of an existing lineage. Okay. So if you zoom in on these changes here, you can look at things like the breakdown between non-synonymous and synonymous variation, and you find actually that what you see in terms of the SNPs that change, sites that change within hosts, they actually accumulate significantly fewer non-synonymous polymorphisms than you would expect just based on pure mutation. Definitely way fewer than you expect when you compare to things like, you know, Valensky lines or yeast populations or sort of anything growing in the lab where DNDS is pretty high. It's, you know, in some ways it's sort of more toward the sort of typical breakdown of synonymous and non-synonymous that you see between different pairs of people, although not 100% there yet. And if you also look at the breakdown between when you get a fixation at a given site, does the new allele take you toward or away from the panel-wide consensus variant at that site? So mutation is something that happens at a consensus base and takes you away from it. A reversion takes you back towards something that already exists in a different host. And so we see a roughly equal, even breakdown between mutations and reversions amongst these different SNPs. And I think what this suggests is that even many of these SNP changes, you know, conditioned on a lot of these being driven by horizontal exchange, it's actually probably likely that many of these SNP changes that we see as well are also hopping in through some of these recombination events, because their sort of spectrum, what we see, doesn't really match up with being generated by mutation. Okay, so for the gene gains and losses overall, we also observe a slightly elevated rate of gene differences between people compared to SNP differences. And so for this one, it's worth noting I took out these replacement examples here so that we wouldn't poison any of the statistics that we see. So we see a larger number both in terms of the sort of fraction of people that undergo a gene change over a short time period, which here is like roughly, you know, 1 in 3 maybe. And the typical number of gene changes, which is roughly 10. These are split pretty evenly between the gains and losses. And if we actually look at the identities or sort of the annotation of sort of the top annotations for the genes that we get, of course, not every gene in our panel is actually annotated, but if we look at the ones that are annotated, it's like a, you know, veritable who's who of things that you might naturally associate with horizontal exchange. So all kinds of transposon-mediated proteins. You know, most of these are actually on a particular transposable element that's known to be sort of going crazy in Bacteroides. You know, some things like phage integrases, various things like that. So I think this is sort of further evidence that a lot of what we're seeing here is this sort of hopping in and out process, mediated maybe by these sorts of mechanisms, although, you know, there's a huge bias in how these things are actually annotated. So that's worth taking with a grain of salt.
Quick question.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you're talking about recombination now, but you haven't looked at origin and terminus proximal genes, where you would anticipate, by definition, you'd have a higher rate of duplication and diversification.
That's a good, yeah, that's a great point, actually. Yeah, yeah, thanks. I'll definitely look at that. We did try to look a little bit about parallelism between, you know, is it the same kind of genes in the same species that are mutated in multiple people? And the answer is no. Like, mostly the genes that you see tend to be kind of unique to a single host, with a few exceptions. Although we also are a little bit biased by trying to be conservative with the genes that we detect. And so you can do another one of these sorts of enrichment kind of curves, where you look at, you know, you have a gene that's changed in one host. You look at, like, what's the next largest copy number change in a different host, and again, you find it sort of significantly elevated than either a randomly drawn gene from the genome or genes that tend to vary between hosts. And so, I think there is some maybe larger parallelism going on, but there's just too many genes and too few ways of coarse graining it to get at that with this small sample. But your suggestion is really great, actually, because distance from origin and terminus are actually a lot. Oh, sorry, you meant within a gene?
No,
from the genome.
From the genome.
It's a much more coarse-grained, kind of thing to aggregate across genes. You know, we've been trying to think of, you know, different ways of categorizing these things to try to get some more functional information, too. I don't know, I'm sort of always skeptical about that kind of thing, because I think we have a poor idea of how things divvy up amongst different biological functions and how to uniquely assign things that way. So, yeah, I'm not sure.
The nutrition link, you'd be able to test that if you looked at metabolism-related genes, just primarily permease.
Yeah, so we actually don't see, so in that list, we actually don't see a whole lot of these. We're sort of hoping to look at this list and see, like, oh yeah, you know, it's these, like, nutrient transporter, you know, but actually most of them all seem to be, associated with the exchange. And so I think what that means sort of for us, thinking about evolution here, is that I think everything we're observing here is a passenger. Right, like, nothing we see here is actually a target of selection itself. Instead, it's just probably linked to something that actually is under selection, and it makes sense we would not be able to see that kind of thing with this really crude reference-based approach, right? Like, the interesting genes are probably the ones that are actually not available in a lot of these strains. So most of the stuff we see here is probably passengers rather than drivers, but they do tell you interesting stuff about what's going on here, which is, you know, even though these could be passengers, we know, since it happens so fast and the population sizes are so big in these gut bacteria populations, that these things have to have been driven by adaptation somewhere else. And you can actually, given the sort of typical timescales that we have here in this data set, they must have been linked to some kind of driver event that had a fitness difference of at least on the order of 1% per day, if not much, much higher if we had sort of finer resolution to sample this. Okay, so yes, we do learn a little bit about that. Sort of last question, all right, good. I think we haven't really talked about yet is, hopefully the previous slides have convinced you that actually a lot of the adaptive variants that are happening in these populations are actually originating through recombination events, right? So some transfer from a different strain. But it's not clear just from that kind of data whether the sweep will, once you get one of these new genes from something else, whether it will just sort of sweep to high frequency clonally on these really short timescales, or whether it will sweep to fixation with sort of the help of some additional recombination and end up leading to sort of a local sweep along the genome, consistent with what we would think about in, like, a fly or a human population, right? So even though there could be a lot of gene exchange going on, this picture would be very consistent with the kinds of dynamics we see in these microbial evolution experiments, where they're basically asexual. It's just these sort of mutation, quote unquote, mutations are just coming from some larger gene pool. And the second example, in contrast, would imply there's actually quite a lot of sex happening within bacteria, even on these short timescales as they're growing, which would be a bit more surprising given the sort of high short timescales we're talking about here. So to try to distinguish between these things, it's a little hard based on these confidently phasable samples we've been working with so far, because by definition we just chose them because they have no other diversity along the genome to confuse us by. But actually, if we go back and focus on these non-confidently phasable samples, we can actually find some that have many, many, many markers along the genome and actually could be used to try to distinguish between these sort of modes of sweeps happening within hosts over short time periods. So we're going to focus on these samples where the first time point is a non-confidently phasable sample, and then the next time point could be either confidently phasable or not, depending on what happened. Okay, so we have to be a little bit more careful with these kind of samples because they have many more alleles at intermediate frequencies, and so actually we have to start being worried about getting kinds of false positives just due to sort of frequency shifts between the two clades, and then something gets sampled at a weird thing and looks like a sweep. So we can't really do this on a broad scale, but if we look carefully and double check the examples we see, I think we can actually see some things. So here's just two individual non-confidently phasable samples that I fished out of that data set, because I think they have good, they illustrate some cool things. So this example here, the individual started as a non-confidently phasable sample and then became a confidently phasable sample at the second time point. And here we can sort of see exactly why this happened. So there were a small number of single nucleotide variants that swept between these two time points. And they actually dragged the rest of the genome to near fixation along with it. So there used to be sort of a broad range, maybe concentrated at sort of 80% here or 70% here. And then, bam, second time point, all of them get shifted up to about 90, maybe driven by one of these few events, although of course it's like super hard to tell in the genome-wide sweep what the true driver was amongst all the passengers. So this example, I think, is a good example of a sort of classic clonal sweep. In contrast, the little dots here, these are just, I'm coloring something. If it is in the same gene as a SNP that actually fixed. And to be careful, I actually restricted it to genes where two SNPs actually fixed, just in case one was a mistake. Okay, so in the second example here, this is a second individual from our panel, which was actually not confidently phasable at both time points. So at time point zero, it had a lot of SNPs concentrated at like maybe 20%, and then at time point two, a lot of them are concentrated at 40%. But in this case, actually, a few SNPs managed to fix in this particular individual in two different genes here. And actually, the green one, I've gone in and looked in detail in IGVI, and it seems to be checking out just fine. So there were four different SNPs that sort of were classified as fixed according to our definition from before. Two of them are on totally different reads. Some of them are on the same read. So I think it's actually sort of a real signal. And these things managed to sweep over 6 months without actually purging any of the other variation in this particular person, which is, given that sort of typical selection coefficients we see here, that's pretty crazy. It implies a super fast recombination rate here. And so maybe these ones were on a gene sort of already in some particular region that's sort of primed to hop in and out and not undergoing this sort of slow process of homologous recombination that we saw with the, in these sort of between host examples, right? So there, the recombination rate was on the order, let's say, of the mutation rate, 10 to the minus 8. Here, the recombination rate has to be on order of, like, the selective coefficient.
This seems really weird to me. Like, have you looked around those two genes and just seen that there's, like, a reasonable signal of reduced diversity decaying the distance that's consistent with the recombination rate?
You might not expect that kind of signal in this context, unfortunately. So we have looked at this a little bit, and that's, I love this figure because I think it's doing that, but in a compressed way. But my collaborators hate this figure and keep telling me to make something where you look at it along the genome.
Yeah.
It's actually a little tricky. So, what you observe are these allele frequencies. They're a little noisy. They can start at different frequencies and end at different frequencies, and often we only just have a small number of them that actually transition. So it's not like in humans or flies where you get this really nice kind of window decaying smoothly. So this one, the one that swept, probably hopped in and hopped out at the same point in all of them, right? If it happened this fast, it's not, basic homologous recombination, right? So I can tell you, these ones I looked at, and I don't think it's a artifact of some weird kind of error or something, but I can tell you nothing about how its sort of genomic context and how it swept. I can tell you that it's roughly 10 kb away from some of these guys here.
But your idea is that some strongly selected thing, there's a few strains in there, somehow it got into each of them and swept independently within each one?
I mean, what if it's just on a plasmid that has a recombination rate of 1%? right? That's enough to lead to the signal that we see here, but it wouldn't lead to any kind of genomic decay, right? Or what if it's in a phase? I don't know. We can speculate about the causes, but so I think we can see examples of both of these things happening, like in the gut in real time, which I think is pretty cool. A little weird if you're thinking about the sort of basic order of magnitudes of these parameters here. And unfortunately, that the limitations of these sort of non-confidently phasable samples mean that I think we just need some better time series data to really quantify, which of these two things is sort of more typical for the between host changes that we see. And if those of you who are more interested, I can talk to you a little bit about some other data sets we're looking at where we can try to get at this in a little better resolution. Okay, so I think with that, pretty good timing. I'll just stop and list some of the sort of basic things I think we've learned from this sort of analysis. So, the basic method is just, it's really dumb, actually. Like, if you just focus on a subset of samples in these really large panels, we're just lucky that some of them are particularly easy to analyze. And so if you focus on those, you can learn some interesting things about the sort of between host population dynamic or population genetics that we see. There's some sort of weird patterns that I mentioned before that don't seem to agree with some of these basic neutral models of evolution, or even some of the simplest selected models of evolution. And so I think it's interesting to think about what kinds of models can reproduce the sort of basic patterns that we see. That if we look at stuff happening within hosts over short time spans, we see a lot of stability in terms of the kinds of strains that are there. They're not totally like freely moving in and out with the environment. Not a whole lot of SNP substitutions compared to these experimental evolution studies, but potentially more instances of gene gain and loss sweeps, which in retrospect maybe aren't surprising given that you'd expect these to have much, much bigger selective advantages than like tweaking a non-synonymous mutation in a random gene. There's a number of sort of open questions still here, which I think are fascinating to think about. But I think I'll end there and thank you guys for your attention.
Yeah. So some people might say, well, the really important thing about microbiomes is to understand their community ecology.
Yes.
So I was wondering, how does this...
There's no community here.
Well, how does this help? Like, how does this kind of analysis help in the long run mm-hmm. to understand the community ecology of microbiomes?
Yeah, so I think on a couple levels. So one thing which is sort of relatively small scale, which I haven't talked about here, is really what I wanted to look at when I was looking at these changes is, say you get a change in a gene here, right? Sweeps within a population. What then changes with the larger community, right? Like, does this always correlate with like an expansion of the bacterial lineage in that species, or does it always correlate with a crash and that's why something fixes? Or these sorts of questions, which unfortunately, given the small number of these events, I'm a little leery of what sorts of broad conclusions we can draw from that with this kind of data. But I think on a bigger level, like, I think what's really interesting about thinking about the evolution, in the microbiome is that we already know there's lots of these species, and we know that there's these super strong ecological selection pressures where you switch somebody's diet, all the species can change. You put them in a different mouse microbiome human microbiome in a mouse and compete it with the mouse microbiome, they'll all go up and down, and the mouse one will take over. All these sorts of things, they depend really strongly on how the ecosystem is set up. And this is interesting from like an ecological point of view because it allows us to play all these games with things competing with each other and setting up species abundance curves. But the really interesting thing to me is that since these are microbes, they acquired this specialization through evolution somehow. And we know almost nothing about how that happened, and we know even less about like how plastic that is on sort of human relevant timescales. Why is it always these ecological changes and not, well, you switch to eating all fat and now your Bacteroides strain wants to acquire some genes that just make it better at fat. And you can sort of go back and forth about whether you expect, one of these things to dominate based on the interaction between the sort of timescales of ecological response and timescales of bacteria producing mutations. And so that's really the thing that I'm interested in understanding from this kind of data is like how do those processes interact and
Well, I mean, for that, you will ultimately have to have some sort of, I mean, you indicated that in some slides, but you will have to have some knowledge about what these genes actually do in the context of the microbiome, I mean, the function of these genes.
Yes, for sure.
And probably the whole situation, you know, let's say the genealogy or various aspects probably depend on the function.
Almost, yes, almost surely. And there's some really great studies out there that are starting to figure out some of this function, either sort of at a really long time scale approach, basically doing GWAS in microbiome bacteria to figure out which genes associate with which locales and diets and things like that, and also just some sort of direct genetic screens by doing like transposon mutagenesis in strains and putting them in mice and tracking how the frequencies go up and down. And so you can learn a lot about sort of basic selection pressures from that kind of study, and I think that'll just get better with time. But I think even if you, this sort of goes back to Michael's talk a little bit, a week or two ago, even if you sort of had perfect knowledge of like what the selective pressures were for all of these things, if you don't actually understand the sort of population genetic environment in which they live, you can't actually predict whether it's beneficial for that, you know, whether that gene that's beneficial will actually take over the population or not. So it depends on these rates and timescales and effective population sizes. And so I guess I sort of view this sort of study as not getting at the function, but getting at the population genetic environment that all these things have to live in. So, yeah, no, it's great.